ebook publishers and marketing services company Just Imagine It, Inc. presents Get Behind Me, Now Stay There, a new fun-filled, informative podcast available on iTunes and right here locally on KSKQ Ashland, Oregon, 89.5 FM. Art and entertainment news and views. Today, for our Halloween show, we talked to Alien Dave in Canada, the Jenks arrive from the City of Angels, and Johnny Depp stars as Hunter S. Thompson in The Rum Diary. We feature the audiobook available from Blackstone, all coming up after this news.
It was many and many a year ago in this kingdom by the sea that a maiden that lived whom you may know by the name of Annabelle Lee. And this maiden, she lived with no other thought than to love and be loved by me. It was me, then she lived with no other thought than to love and be loved by me.
Hello, and thank you for joining us. I'm Edgar Allan Poe.
And I'm Catwoman, ready to scratch the surface of the art and entertainment world. For all of his years in the spotlight at the helm of Apple, Steve Jobs in many ways remains an inscrutable figure, even in his death. Fiercely private, Jobs concealed most specifics about his personal life, from his curious family life to the details of his battle with pancreatic cancer, a disease that ultimately claimed him at the age of 56. While the CEO and co-founder of Apple steered most interviews away from the public fascination with his private life, there's plenty we know about Jobs, the person, beyond the Mac and the iPhone. If anything, the obscure details of his interior life paint a subtler, more nuanced portrait of the man. Jobs was born in San Francisco on February 24, 1955. He was adopted shortly after his birth and reared near Mountain View, California, by a couple named Clara and Paul Jobs. His adoptive father, a term that Jobs openly objected to, was a machinist for a laser company, while his mother worked as an accountant. The lead mind behind the most successful company on the planet never graduated from college. In fact, he didn't even get close. After graduating from high school in Cupertino, California, Jobs enrolled in Reed College in 1972. He stayed at Reed, a liberal arts university in Portland, for only one semester, dropping out quickly due to the financial burden the private school's steep tuition placed on his parents. Jobs said of his time at Reed, "It wasn't all romantic. I didn't have a dorm room, so I slept on the floor in friends' rooms. I returned Coke bottles for the 5-cent deposit to buy food with, and I would walk the 7 miles across town every Sunday night to get one good meal a week at the Hare Krishna Temple." Like the rest of his family, Jobs kept his marriage out of the public eye. Thinking back on his legacy conjures images of him commanding the stage in his trademark black turtleneck and jeans, and those solo moments are his most iconic. But at home in Palo Alto, Jobs was raising a family with his wife, Laureen. For all of his single-minded dedication to the company he built from the ground up, Jobs actually skipped a meeting to take Laureen on their first date. "I was in the parking lot with the key in the car, and I thought to myself, if this is my last night on earth, would I rather spend it at a business meeting or with this woman? I ran across the parking lot, asked her if she'd have dinner with me, and she said yes. And we walked into town, and we've been together ever since." In 1991, Jobs and Powell were married in the Ahwahnee Hotel at Yosemite National Park, and the marriage was officiated by Kobin Chino, a Zen Buddhist monk. When he was 23, Jobs and his high school girlfriend, Chris Ann Brennan, conceived a daughter, Lisa Brennan Jobs. She was born in 1978, just as Apple began picking up steam in the tech world. He and Brennan never married. But he went on to father 3 more children with Laureen Powell. And after later mending their relationship, Jobs paid for his first daughter's education at Harvard. She graduated in 2000 and now works as a magazine writer. In a few interviews, Jobs hinted at his early experience with LSD. He called his experience with the drug one of the 2 or 3 most important things I have done in my life. As Jobs himself has suggested, LSD may have contributed to the think different approach that still puts Apple's designs ahead above the competition. Jobs will forever be a visionary, with his personal life reflecting the forward-thinking, alternative approach that vaulted Apple to success. During a trip to India, Jobs visited a well-known ashram and returned to the U.S. as a Zen Buddhist. While there's no word yet on plans for his estate, Jobs leaves behind 3 children from his marriage to Lorraine Jobs, as well as his first daughter.
Well, that's really sad. Steve Jobs, he really changed America with the iPod and, you know, Apple computers.
Changed the world.
Changed the world, exactly.
He was one of my heroes. The man was brilliant, supremely creative, and a good guy.
Well, here's another celebrity near and dear to everybody's heart. Yes, Johnny Depp will take those millions. Thanks. The star of this month's The Rum Diary has 3 more projects in the works. It's no wonder Forbes estimated that the well-paid actor pulled in $50 million last year, and he's trying to rake it in while the cash is flowing. Basically, if they're going to pay me this stupid money right now, I'm going to take it, the 48-year-old star told Vanity Fair in the magazine's November issue. I have to. I mean, it's not for me. Do you know what I mean? At this point, it's for my kids. It's ridiculous. Yeah, but ultimately, is it for me? No, it's for the kids. But even though his bank account's changed, a writer who has known Depp for more than 10 years says he's still the same old Johnny. It is obvious that being photographed all the time hasn't gotten any easier for the actor. You just feel like you're being raped somehow. Raped. The whole thing, it feels like a kind of weird, just weird, man. Depp says of getting his photo snapped. That comparison drew criticism on Tuesday, and Depp has since responded. I'm truly sorry for offending anyone in any way. I never meant to. It was a poor choice of words on my part, in an effort to explain a feeling, he says in a statement on the Huffington Post. I understand there is no comparison, and I am very regretful. In an effort to correct my lack of judgment, please accept my heartfelt apology. That's the problem with being a celebrity. Everything you say gets magnified, I guess.
Yeah. That's a pretty good imitation of Johnny Depp.
You like that, huh? Well, thank you. Yeah, now for the Academy Award.
Is there something?
I'm Edgar Allan Poe today.
Wait, is there something inside of you that has a kinship with Johnny Depp?
Yeah,
you kind of look like him.
We're both Cherokees.
Honest to God.
Yeah.
Isn't that wow? Interesting.
Yeah.
Wow.
We have that in common.
Yeah, that's a big common too.
Definitely.
Oh, that's a very cool common. Wow, great. Well, speaking of movie stars and movies and films, it's One for All and All for One. Athos, Porthos, and Aramis will be swashbuckling their way down the red carpet in London for the world premiere of The Three Musketeers in 3D. The trio of actors taking on the legendary characters, Matthew McFadden, Ray Stevenson, and Luke Evans, will be joined at Tuesday's launch by Logan Lerman, who plays the hot-headed colleague, D'Artagnan. Other stars at the premiere include Mila Jovovich. Is that how you say your name?
Sounds good to me.
Who portrays the mysterious Milady, Orlando Bloom, who takes on the dastardly Duke of Buckingham, and director Paul W.S. Anderson of Resident Evil fame. The family adventure sees the 17th century band of heroes set out to defend the Queen's honor and protect France from war. The Three Musketeers in 3D opens in the UK on October 12th. I love that story.
The Three Musketeers, they just keep redoing it and making it
better
new
and better.
Fresh. Yeah, and now 3D.
I know. Have you seen the trailers?
Yeah, I have. It looks very exciting.
Oh, it looks amazingly exciting. I can't wait to see it.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a fun film, and I love the candy bar as well.
Oh, I hate the candy bar. No, I'm just kidding.
Trick or treat.
All right.
Well, here's something else you might want to get when you're going around to people's houses. Amazon's new Kindle Fire tablet is already setting off some privacy alarms in the security community. set for a November 15th release, the Kindle Fire, a full-color, 8GB, 7-inch multi-touch tablet, stands poised to go head-to-head with the iPad. The Kindle Fire's competitive standing, however, is already hampered by what some security experts see as a troubling invasion of privacy on Amazon's part. The concern lies in the Kindle Fire's web browser called Silk, and specifically in how Silk promises to speed up surfing and increase battery life. Silk routes all web connections through Amazon's Elastic Compute Cloud, EC2, so rather than directing traffic from the Kindle Fire to the desired web page, transmissions will connect first through the cloud. When you use Silk, without thinking about it or doing anything explicit, you're calling on the computing speed and power of the Amazon Web Services cloud, reads Amazon's product description. By accessing the cloud, the Kindle Fire promises to increase battery life and increase web connection speeds. In the terms and conditions for Silk, Amazon writes that URLs, as well as certain identifiers, such as IP or MAC addresses, will be stored on its servers for 30 days. This doesn't sit well with researcher Chris Espinoza, a senior employee at Apple who took to his blog to vent about the mine of private data that Amazon will have access to with the Kindle Fire. Amazon will capture and control every web transaction performed by Fire users, Espinoza wrote. Every page they see, every link they follow, every click they make, every ad they see is going to be intermediated by one of the largest server farms on the planet. People who cringe at the data mining implications of the Facebook timeline ought to be just floored by the magnitude of Amazon's opportunity here. Fortunately, Amazon will enable Fire tablet owners to use Silk without routing traffic through the cloud. Connection speeds will be slower, yet it might be a sacrifice worth making. Amazon did not return a call for comment. So it sounds like the competition between Amazon and Apple is really heating up.
Yeah, it does.
And without Steve Jobs, it'll be interesting to see how it plays out for sure.
You know, I find it very interesting because he was such a... privacy was so important to him. And the Apple people are also voicing that privacy issue. And I think rightly so.
Well, yeah, and I think Amazon has responded to the privacy issue that, you know, they do allow users to avoid the cloud, you know, and access their information on the web directly. But, you know, they have to make the sacrifice for slower speeds and battery life. Their battery won't last as long on the Kindle Fire. So, I mean, they did address it.
Which is a good thing.
Which is a good thing, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of your Cherokee brother... Johnny Depp's company, Infinitum Nihil, will release the soundtrack to his next film, The Rum Diary, through Lakeshore Records. A first for his company, the album will be released digitally October 25th and on CD November 29th. It contains Christopher Young's score, inspired by the popular large ensemble jazz of the 1950s and the early 60s, two songs by the Johnny Depp Band, an instrumental by Depp, and a duet between Johnny Depp and J.J. Holliday. Dean Martin's Volare and Patti Smith's The Mermaid Song are also on the album. Ooh, that sounds great.
Yeah.
Anyway, Young's goal when he recorded the music was to get it released on a jazz label. Depp, who wrote and recorded more music for The Rum Diary than any of his other films, signed on to release the album right after he heard the music. Most of the tracks, and I'm going to not do this in the Johnny Depp accent, most of the tracks on the CD were presented as thematic possibilities for the film, says Young, a former jazz drummer who studied music at UCLA and the jazz powerhouse North Texas State in the 1970s. This gives me a chance to pour out music that has been inside me for all these years. To promote the album and film, which comes out October 28th, Young has assembled a 20-piece big band with strings, dubbed the Neon Popsicles, to play selections from The Rum Diary at Catalina Bar and Grill in Los Angeles on October 24th. I'm a little nervous, says Young, whose credits include two Spider-Man movies, Ghost Rider, and The Shipping News. Never in all my years would I think I could put together a band to play my music live outside a recording studio. But I'm really excited, he concluded.
So yeah, Johnny Depp's in the music scene now. It's about time something good happened for that guy.
What a great talent. I mean, he has such a broad spectrum of areas that he excels in. It's pretty amazing.
Very talented.
Very talented.
Yeah.
And cute.
I guess, yeah, all the girls like him for sure, huh?
Yeah, all the girls like him, that's for sure.
Or women.
And women.
And women.
I'm not a girl.
Yeah, I'm not stepping in on that landmine for sure. Well, here's a chapter from the Marijuana Diaries. 24 hours after federal agents took their marijuana crops, medical marijuana growers in Gold Hill say the search was unjustified and over the top. The growers and users say it was an attack on their freedom as Oregon medical marijuana cardholders. It's still unconfirmed by officials whether or not the medical marijuana grow sites were legal under state law. Under federal law, growing and using marijuana is illegal, period. One cardholder says that law enforcement just came in and stuck guns in their faces and threw them to the ground. The tenants insist they were following Oregon law. The DEA had a tractor and started digging out the plants on the property. In the meantime, no charges or arrests have been made. The U.S. Attorney's Office told KOBI-TV that a federal warrant was served, and that was all he could say. While at the grow site, agents confiscated all the marijuana and kept the medical cards. You know, Catwoman, I have an issue with the word marijuana. You know why?
Why?
Well, I did a little research, and it turns out around 1920, William Randolph Hearst's national newspaper chain introduced the word marijuana through yellow journalism. The word comes from a little-known slang term used in a Pancho Villa celebration song. The hysteria caused by these articles led to the Marijuana Tax Act, making hemp illegal at the same time Popular Mechanics magazine dubbed it the new billion-dollar crop. It was a political move by Hearst and DuPont to cut down forests for paper and make us dependent on fossil fuel textile products patented by DuPont, the same fossil fuels we fight for in the Middle East today. If hemp were legal, we may not have a reason to be fighting two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, all because of a word.
Mr. Poe, that is really fascinating. I didn't know anything about that. Thanks for sharing that with us.
Yeah, you're welcome. I learned that from the book Hemp, Lifeline to the Future by Chris Conrad.
Well, I'll put that on my Christmas list for you, Mr. Poe.
Sounds good.
And for those of you that never inhaled the Decade of Difference concert at the Hollywood Bowl celebrated Bill Clinton's 65th birthday and the 10-year milestone of the Clinton Foundation. Throughout the night, unexpected moments surprised, shocked, and in the end delighted the crowd. Lady Gaga. The moment that had everyone buzzing on Twitter was a backstage conversation between Lady Gaga and the Clintons. Lady Gaga switched outfits to a retro-looking gold gown with elbow-length gloves and even a faux beauty mark, solidifying the Marilyn Monroe comparison. She showed up in another backstage pose before the concert with former President Bill Clinton and also Chelsea. Lady Gaga and Chelsea Clinton shared the image on her Facebook page and said, "A highlight of tonight was meeting Lady Gaga backstage. Her combination of creativity, intelligence, and activism are inspiring. And yes, she's even more remarkable on stage than on YouTube."
Yeah, I saw that streaming on Yahoo. Catwoman, were you out on the prowl for that? Did you see it?
Absolutely. Yow. Well, it was a great show for a great cause.
Yeah, we talked about it. I think it was on the last show. We talked about it a little bit.
Yeah. Lady Gaga. Cool.
Yeah, it was a great show. And what a surprise. Stevie Wonder opening it up.
Oh,
and then,
I love Stevie Wonder.
Yeah, and then Bono and The Edge.
And I love Bono.
Yeah, and he did Miss Sarajevo. He did an Italian singing it in opera.
Like a great tenor.
Yeah, it was amazing. I mean, he stopped time.
Yeah.
You know, when he hit that note and he carried it. I mean, everybody just stopped what they were doing, and
yeah,
it was amazing.
It was wonderful.
Yeah, and the Jenks, who we feature on this show, they've got an opera coming up too. So yeah, I guess
okay.
Let's wrap it up.
And that's your art and entertainment news. Keep listening for Blackstone Audio's special feature.
Time has no mercy. Life takes its toll. We keep on moving to gain control. In the cities, so mystified. It's so pretty. It'll blow your mind.
And there's always something that you cannot have.
Dave Allen is known to some as Alien Dave. He may or may not know my cat Pluto. He did speak to Lord Stanton about his music, though.
Welcome to another episode of Get Behind Me Now, Stay There. Today we're talking with Dave Allen from Vancouver, Canada, BC. How you doing, Dave?
I'm doing good, thanks.
I understand you're in Toronto right now.
Yeah, for sure. Toronto's been a great city for me, so I come here once in a while, and I work really hard every day, and today I woke up and I ran 2.5 miles and just have fun, you know?
Well, you know, on the CD that we heard, you know, there's several great tracks on it. Now, is there a favorite track of yours, or one that means something in particular to you?
You know what? They all do, because when I write a song, to me, I really dig deep, and I try to, in my own way and idea, I try to create a piece of art, you know?
Right.
So I think, you know, they all kind of come from that perspective, you know? I'm really picky when I'm writing, so I'm throwing out so much stuff, and I'm looking for those unique angles that just potentially can stand apart from everything else that's out there, right?
You know, it really does, and I know it's kind of an often asked question to songwriters and composers is, you know, do you write the music first, or do you write the lyrics, or do they happen at the same time?
It's different all the time, right? Like that song, Killing Time, I wrote the lyrics first, and in the chorus that goes,
Oh, beautiful.
And it just kind of built a strong hook, right?
It is.
So, I mean, that song was built around the lyric, right? But a lot of songs, I just start out looking for a hook, you know, in the music, right?
Right. There's a track, it's got the chorus in there going, you know,
it's all right, crystal blue dancer, baby, all through the night.
Oh, it's Crystal Blue Dancer, I think.
Yeah, okay.
It's an up-tempo rock kind of song, right?
Exactly, yeah. It starts off the CD.
Yeah, it's you know what? That was one of the first 5 songs I ever wrote in my life.
Really?
Yeah.
It sounds like it comes from a real polished musician. It's a real rocker, you know. In the way you've got the girls in the background doing the chorus, you know, it's all right. You know, it's great.
Oh yeah. No. We recorded it all at the same time. I re-recorded it, but that was literally one of the first 5 songs I ever wrote in my life when I was around 21, 22.
Wow. Well, it was a job well done.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. And the thing is, every time I went into the recording studio and everybody's like, well, you know what? You got to re-record that song, right? So I
right.
kept recording it and recording it and so on, you know. So, yeah, no, I just, I guess one of those songs, you know, people.
Well, I enjoy it. Right? And everyone I played for it really likes it. Now, are we... Didn't you have a song that someone is going to record? Somewhere there's a place called home?
Oh, yeah. It's called Somewhere Out There. Yeah, a friend of mine, Phil Merrow, he actually, I've known him since 1986 here in Toronto, and he's a pretty accomplished musician, you know, and singer, and he sang on that. I gave him all the music on an MP3 file, and he gave him permission to, you know, have freedom as far as creating his own vocal melody, and he sang on it, and it turned out amazing. So he took it to New York and let his buddies down there hear it, and they're want to put it on the album. So they're all pretty heavyweight players, you know.
No, great. It's, you know, yeah. I love that song. It's you talk about a hook, Dave. You know, I catch myself walking around the house going.
Somewhere out there is a place called home.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know what? I mean, I'll you won't be able to hear it now, but I'll send you the MP3 with him singing on it.
Okay.
And I mean, people, you know, I mean, it's what it is, but people have always enjoyed that song the way I did it.
Uh-huh.
But the way my friend Phil did it is awesome as well. I mean, he's got like a 4 octave vocal range, and he just took it to a different level. It's completely different, but nevertheless, it's just like this hardcore rocker kind of singer.
You know, I've only heard your version, and I really like it a lot. I mean, I really, a good barometer for me is like, you know, if I get a song and it's like stuck in my head, I was like, you know,
yeah.
Then I'm like, wow, I love this song, right?
Yeah, wow. Thank you, yeah.
I'm curious to hear Phil's version as well.
Those guys did a great job, too, though, eh, Charlie. They, you know, Phil did an amazing job. And the guitar player, he plays with Lou Gramm, a Foreigner, and Ian Gillan of Deep Purple, and Dan McCafferty of Nazareth, you know. And he, when he met me, and he's like, oh, you're the guy who wrote that, you know. And he's like, wow.
Well, you know, all the musicians you have on there, Dave, are just, you know, I mean, when you hear it, and, you know, by this time in the interview, all of the listeners out there have heard a few of the tracks, and so I'm sure everyone agrees with me. You guys just rock. You're really a tight band.
Wow, thank you. Well, you know what? It's not actually even a band. It was just a compilation of friends of mine and people that I hired and so on, and... And all of them became my friends, you know, and just piecing it all together. So,
well, the finished product is wonderful.
Awesome, thank you.
So,
I'm actually looking forward to hearing my friend's rendition of that song Somewhere Out There, because they're gonna have a full band and a 4-piece orchestra playing that song.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow, that's gonna be quite something, eh?
Yeah, so, you know, I'll definitely let you know when that is, right?
So, what, any plans to come back to the U.S. of A. here anytime soon?
Yeah. As soon as I finish this job, probably in October, early November, I'm going to be in Vancouver, and then I'll probably be down that way about December-ish. And, yeah, just get out of Canada for the winter.
There you go. The Canada's really up. I'm sure it's pretty...
Let me out.
Yeah, let me out, dude. It's cold here. So, Dave, we look forward to you coming down here. And, you know, once again, this has been Dave Allen from Vancouver, Canada, currently in Toronto at the moment. And you guys have heard some just fantastic music here that we've put in between the breaks. And, Dave, we'd love to have you come back on again when... Your album drops. Would you consider doing that for us?
Definitely. That'd be great. Thank you, Charlie. I appreciate that. And, yeah, it's awesome. So I'll keep in touch and let you know when the album's out, and we'll take it from there.
Okay. Do you have a working title for the album yet, or still working on it?
Well, for this CD, actually, we're going to call it Alien Dave.
Oh, I like it.
And the album title is going to be called Alienated.
Oh, wow. That's good. Awesome. And it's been so great talking to you, Dave, and I look forward to seeing you again.
Yeah, thank you. Good night.
To learn more about Dave Allen, visit us on our website at justimagineitinc.com.
As a supervillainess, I've seen quite a few catastrophic acts in my day, unlike the Janks, who are pure catnip to my ears. Meow. They spoke with the president of Just Imagine It, Inc., Charlie Stanton.
All right, welcome to another exciting episode of Get Behind Me, Not Stay There. And today we have on the Janks from Los Angeles, California. They have a new CD out called The Hands of Time. Hey, welcome, guys.
Yeah, hey. Great to be here.
It's great to have you.
Yeah.
For all the people out there listening, you know, we went and saw them last night, and they just did a killer performance, and we're shooting some videos out here in Ashland, Oregon. How'd you guys like that experience?
Cold?
It wasn't that cold.
No, yeah, it was great.
It was fun. Well, I enjoyed really it. Cool.
Maybe next time we can import a palm tree or something and make it a little more at home.
No, it was lovely. It was great.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we're in the studio, so we got a few questions for you that we're wanting to know. Which one do you like better, recording in the studio or performing live?
They both have, like, pros and cons.
Right.
I'm Dylan. And
hey, Dylan.
Hey, just so people know, I guess. But
okay.
Yeah, no, I personally feel like I really enjoy recording. Because it's almost like painting in a way, and I have a studio art degree in painting, so I kind of get served in a different way. Whereas playing live is different. It's because it's just it's right in the moment, and there's no Zach's stomach's growling. Hopefully that was picked up on the mic.
That's real loud.
Wow.
Wow.
See, that's what happens when you play live.
Oh, I see.
Turkey burgers. yeah.
What do you guys think about?
Yeah.
Well,
yes, Garth.
I think the perfect ratio of recording to performing for me is probably about 80-20. Because I don't know, I just love being able to get an idea down, to really take the time to get it as close to what you want and envision. And performing is a totally different mindset. You know, when you're performing, it's not, the song is even, it's kind of secondary to the performance, you know, just delivering it and making that moment as realized and as energized as possible.
Yeah. I like what you said. That makes a lot of sense. I would say my ratio would probably be, would fluctuate between, you know, 40-60 and 60-40. And, but yeah, you know, just, I agree. Being able to get something down the way that you want it in your head is, I love that. I absolutely love it. But yeah, then abandoning it all and, you know, just owning the moment is a lot of fun, you know, and not worrying about, you know, that take for posterity. It's, you know, it's just a fleeting moment, and it's great. It's great. So they both have their ups and downs. Agreed. Agreed with both you guys.
Oh, great. And that was Zach for everybody out there listening. Now, you know, speaking of performing live, when we saw you guys play last night, you played like you were at Wembley Stadium. I mean, you were just like that good. I was like, are these guys must have been rehearsing for, you know, 1,000 hours, you know, just for this 1 hour worth of performance.
Gotcha, Charlie. Gotcha.
That's very kind of you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Oh, man.
Because that was not how we felt.
Well, you know, that's good. I heard John Lennon say once that even after all the years and as famous as they were, that every time he performed, he still got a stomach, was in a knot. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, if you don't feel nervous going on stage, then you're probably not going to do very well.
Yeah, you got to really care about what you're doing, you know. I think sometimes, like last night, maybe there were moments where we were a little in our heads, but, you know.
That happens.
That's pretty normal. And it's one thing I've noticed is when you listen back to a recording, you can't really notice that they were in their heads, you know, the performer was in their heads. I mean, I've listened to stuff where the process was really painful. I was listening back to a jam or something like that where I was just struggling the whole time. And then I listen back and it sounds really fluid. And like, I'm just like, so it's a very different thing.
We'll never be the best judges of our performances because we're our own worst critics, you know. So we'll leave it to you, Charlie, and whoever else is there to decide, you know, how good of a show it was that we played.
That's
well, I thought it was fantastic, and the music just was great, you know.
Awesome.
It was actually I was impressed, and I hear a lot of bands, and you guys were, you know, you were really that good. So,
thank you.
Keep
thank
making
you.
Great music. Now, you know, speaking of that, now for everybody out there listening, they have a video out called Dead Man.
I'm a dead man for sure.
And, you know, I've seen it, and I don't want to give away too much of it because it has kind of a surprise ending to it. But who came up with that that idea? And tell us about it.
Gary Lundgren.
Okay.
He lives in Ashland, and he made a film called Calvin Marshall up in Ashland. And he met our manager Rich Reese.
Uh-huh.
From being up in Ashland, living here, and we kind of just developed a relationship with him, and he thought of this idea when he heard the song Dead Man that Zach wrote. And, just like we thought it would be great to kind of go to this kind of different twisted area and take it in a different light. And just we went on the ride. It was fun.
Yeah, it was cool. Because it's not what I imagined, you know, when writing the song. It was definitely not what I imagined. And I liked the fact that he was doing something that was unexpected, you know, because we'll make plenty of our own videos that reflect our own personal visions of songs, and so it was nice to get a take from someone else.
Well, you know, I saw the video, and you know, the song's great. You know, I listened to your CD many times, and actually have it loaded in my iPod.
Woo!
And when I saw the video, I was like, wow, this is really something. This is different, you know. And for everybody out there, you can see it on YouTube, and you can also see it on the Janks.com. And pardon me,
the Janks Music.
Janksmusic.com, sorry. And you can also see it on justimagineinc.com. So that leads me to my next question about videos. So I saw you guys, you were shooting some videos last night. So I wanted to know if, like, shooting videos now is, since you guys are, you know, really, you know, starting to take off, is shooting videos, are they still fun to make, or are they like a giant pain in the ass?
The coolest thing in the world.
Oh, okay.
Well, I got a little excited. No, they're great. It's awesome. It's like the coolest thing to be, you know, it's your music and people are making like a vision out of it. And, you know, it's really exciting, I think. But it's all depends on how you look at it. 'Cause I think it could be really obnoxious too, I'm sure.
So far, it's been great.
But I mean, yeah,
we've actually done, I think, up to 4 videos now, 2 of which were with Gary Lundgren. And, you know, with Gary, he just kind of took it on himself. He's kind of a visionary. He had the whole plan, assembled the whole crew, so easy to work with. It was just a pleasure the whole way through. And we met a bunch of great people doing that. And then another video we shot was with this great dancer, choreographer and videographer Dola Baroni out in Los Angeles. And, you know, that was just so extemporaneous. We got together, we did some, everybody did different dancing. This is for a song, Separation From Your Body, another song on the record. That was awesome. And then there was another video we did where Dylan did animation, and I was so blown away with the work that he did on that. I mean, so far so good. It's all the videos have been so fun and
creatively serving.
Sure, yeah. I've been really happy with the outcome of all those videos.
Well, the videos I've seen that you guys have made have, you know, all been really good. And, you know, again, last night we got a chance to see you guys actually making the video. And I have never, you know, been involved with that before. And, boy, there's a lot more that goes into it than I thought. You know, I just thought you'd like, you know, okay, turn the camera on and let's go.
And that was more just like, it took like 20, 30 minutes to do. But the videos we've done in the past, they've taken like a full day to have like sequence of shots and directing.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Dead Man's almost like a little miniature movie there.
Yeah, yeah, well, can't be horror film. Yeah, it's great.
Well, you know, I also was researching your bands, and you list, you know, some influences from the Kinks to the Queen is what it says on the website. So with that in mind, I had this question for you. You know, on your current CD, Hands of Time, if Queen was one of your influences and Freddie Mercury were still alive, what song would he sing off the CD?
Okay. He'd sing Adolescence.
There's no vocals on Adolescence.
Oh, yeah.
That's a great question.
Well, he could probably sing it now then.
Yeah.
I don't know. I could imagine him singing Child Prodigy.
I was thinking that one too.
Or maybe.
Or Hands of Time.
You watch Love Time. Hands of Time.
Or even Get Out of Town.
If you had any sense, you'd get out of town. Hit the ground running and never look back. But till you're old, life's starting new. You can do anything.
I feel like he does that, oh, yeah, that soft, breathy thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe those three tunes.
He might surprise us all, though.
But he could sing everything that I sung better.
Yeah, he's amazing.
We love Freddie. Miss you, Freddie.
Now, do you guys, you know, when you're touring, is there somebody that you, you know, haven't played with yet that you want to play with?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. Everyone.
I mean, yeah. I want to play with everyone. I mean, maybe not everyone. But yeah, there are just so many great artists out there that we know of or don't even know of yet. That, you know, I think just being out in the world and playing more, it's going to be great. Hopefully more opportunities to meet people, meet more bands. And but yeah, I mean, there are a lot, definitely. I don't know if that answers the question.
Oh, sure, yeah. Sure it does. Ian, any plans for your next CD, or are you working on it right now? Or
yeah.
We got the rock opera. We just decided recently. We're, I came to the band, I don't know, maybe about a month ago, and was like, you know, we should really write a rock operetta together. And everybody was kind of feeling that. We didn't have any direction, but we knew that was something that would work because some of the music is really theatrical. I think Zach's voice and Dylan's voice, you know, their voices,
I think they can really carry on a stage. And, you know, just a couple weeks ago, we were together and Zach had this idea for something we could do for it. And it's just been, it was a springboard. All of a sudden, we have a bunch of music for it and it's really coming together. It's something we're hoping to perform and record over the course of the next 6 or 7 months.
Wow, that'd be great. Yeah. Is there a theme to it?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, taking from numerous places, but kind of taking from the story of Hermaphroditus and Salmacus. It's so the story of how Hermaphroditus was born a boy, and Salmacus is this freshwater nymph who kind of falls in love with him and captures him and wants to possess him and asks the gods to make them one. And then he basically takes on the female genitalia as well. And so we kind of like took that idea and we're still writing it. But the idea is, you know, for this love story between, you know, a woman with more masculine energy and a man with more, feminine energy. And they somehow meet up and it works and they kind of like cross over in some way. And sometimes the line is blurred on, you know, so we're dealing a little bit with identity and sexuality and
essentially a love story, but yeah. Transcendent in the sense that it's hopefully it gets beyond, you know, the gender. It gets beyond some of the traditional notions of love that that we're used to. And we'll be drawing on a lot of mythology, but also having elements that are kind of current, and just, you know, songs. Like a lot of, I think at its core, it's going to be material songs that sound like the Jinx.
Oh, great. You know, I'd be looking forward to that. And it sounds like you guys are breaking some barriers with that. I would really, you know, look forward to hearing it. And where can we see you guys live next?
You can see us live on the 25th of October in Los Angeles at the Bootleg Theater.
Great.
And after that, December 10th at the Breathing Room in Los Angeles. Yeah.
All right. All right. Well, I have one final question for you. And this is for all our female fans out there and who would like to know who is the best looking.
I would have to go with Dylan. Dylan is like, he's like Jesus. He's beautiful.
He's really? Like buff Jesus.
He's buff Jesus. He's Jesus that plays water polo. Yeah.
Bless you, my friends.
All right. Well, you know, once again, it's the Jenks, and their new album is Hands of Time, and it's available on iTunes and everywhere that fine music is sold. And it's been great having you guys on. We really look forward to talking with you again. And hopefully you'll come back to next time you're in Ashland and play some music for us.
That'd be awesome.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, guys. And be sure to look for the Jenks on Facebook. And be sure to like them on Facebook, as we have. And once again, that was the Jenks from Los Angeles, California.
To learn more about the Jenks, visit us at justimagineitinc.com.
The Rum Diary, starring Johnny Depp, is one of many movie tie-ins available from Blackstone Audio, Inc. Begun in 1959 by a then 22-year-old Hunter S. Thompson, the audiobook is a brilliantly tangled love story of jealousy, treachery, and violent alcoholic lust in a Caribbean boomtown that was San Juan, Puerto Rico, in the late 1950s. The book's hero, a young writer dreaming of Hemingway, but stuck in a dead-end newspaper job, embarks on a carousing, hell-raising journey through the tropics. Along the way, he comes between a wild-spirited comrade and his temptress girlfriend and gets in the middle of a violent clash between the island culture and the encroaching American tourist values. Exuberant and energetic, The Rum Diary is an outrageous, drunken romp in the spirit of Thompson's best-selling Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas and Hell's Angels.
In the early 50s, when San Juan first became a tourist town, an ex-jockey named Al Arbonito built a bar in the patio behind his house on Calle O'Leary. He called it Al's Backyard and hung a sign above his doorway on the street with an arrow pointing between two ramshackle buildings to the patio and back. At first he served nothing but beer, at 20 cents a bottle, and rum at a dime a shot or 15 cents with ice. After several months he began serving hamburgers, which he made himself. It was a pleasant place to drink, especially in the mornings, when the sun was still cool, and the salt mist came up from the ocean to give the air a crisp, healthy smell that, for a few early hours, would hold its own against the steaming, sweaty heat that clamps San Juan at noon and remains until long after sundown. It was good in the evenings, too, but not so cool. Sometimes there would be a breeze, and Al's would usually catch it because of the fine location, at the very top of Calle O'Leary Hill, so high that if the patio had windows, you could look down on the whole city. But there is a thick wall around the patio, and all you can see is the sky and a few plantain trees. As time passed, Al bought a new cash register. Then he bought wood umbrella tables for the patio, and finally moved his family out of the house on Calle O'Leary, out in the suburbs, to a new urbanization near the airport. He hired a large Negro named Sweep, who washed the dishes and carried hamburgers, and eventually learned to cook. He turned his old living room into a small piano bar and got a pianist from Miami, a thin, sad-faced man named Nelson Otto. The piano was midway between the cocktail lounge and the patio. It was an old baby grand, painted light gray and covered with a special shellac to keep the salt air from ruining the finish. And 7 nights a week, through all 12 months of the endless Caribbean summer, Nelson Otto sat down at the keyboard to mingle his sweat with the weary chords of his music.
Hunter S. Thompson, 1937 to 2005, was born and raised in Louisville, Kentucky. His books on politics and society were regarded as groundbreaking among journalists, and he was celebrated as one of the early practitioners of an outraged form of angry journalism that became known as gonzo journalism. His numerous articles for Rolling Stone and books like Hell's Angels and Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas brought him wide recognition and cult-like status. For more information about top-selling titles from this award-winning company, go to blackstoneaudio.com. Get Behind Me Now, Stay There is a Just Imagine Inc. presentation and was recorded in the Blackstone Audio Inc. studios in Ashland, Oregon. If you would like more information about this show, or if you or someone you know would like to be featured, please call 541-708-0525 or visit justimagineinc.com. I'm Edgar Allan Poe.
And I'm Catwoman, wishing everyone a perfectly wonderful All Hallows Eve.
She can't hear a glass call. Something in a way. There's not much.